Hello, humans. Welcome to Audio Face bonus episode about Muse.
Haven't done one of these in a minute.
Yeah, we haven't done. We gotta do more with these when we have the time. But definitely, Muse is one of these artists that really actually established Dan and I's friendship early years in junior high, because he was one of the only other people I knew who genuinely liked Muse a lot, especially like Resistance era when that came out and was like huge. And I was like, I feel like I'm the only person that's talking about this.
Is a feeling that you had for like 2.5 minutes. Then everyone knew about Resistance.
Exactly.
But it was definitely one of our, we felt cool because we knew about this first. I hadn't gone through the Radiohead iceberg. You hadn't gone through like the Gorillaz iceberg yet. So like Muse was something we were both able to just like two hands collaborating and meeting in one, like kind of thing. Like we're both like equally as versed in it. And it's a band that we've gone through all like history. They've been storied for about like 20 years or so, still making music. And of course we're releasing this. We usually do these bonus episodes in the lead up to new records. And Muse is going to be releasing their latest record, Will of the People, very shortly. I want to say this is album number 9. So we have a lot of music to go through. We have a lot of history to go through with Muse and to kind of go through with them. And a little bit of Audio Face lore here. We have certain disagreements about certain albums in the Muse discography, probably even stronger than our Radiohead disagreements and our Gorillaz disagreements, which are like few, but like they're there.
There's very few of those, but yeah. There's definitely disagreements here.
And there is deep, deep, deep in the Audio Face archives, and another Muse episode that we did. I mean, I, because Sean was on some vacation. I really can't remember. We have to like look at the date.
I think I was racing.
That makes sense. Yeah. And so I did the Muse bonus on my own, and we didn't get to talk about our, you know, differences and what we liked about it with the Muse record. So it only made sense that we actually do this as a proper bonus album, or sorry, bonus episode. So let's jump in it.
Yeah. So kind of an introduction to Muse, 3-piece band, which is rare these days, from Devon, England, doing alt rock and stuff. And they've been together since the mid-90s, I would say.
94.
I know they've been together since 94. Shit, they've been together as long as Radiohead. That's actually really crazy to think about it, because I always think them like always like being newer in a way, but I forget that we're old now. So they definitely have been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, they... with Matt Bellamy being like the lead vocals, guitars, Chris Wolstenholme being bass and backing vocals, and then Dominic Howard on drums, they really cemented
them. I think Chris is a very underrated bass player and vocalist, because I think some of the stuff he does is incredible.
Oh yeah, like Muse combines hard rock and electronic with, honestly,
grunge
and... I guess you could call it art rock, but I call it like classical music, honestly, because you get you get pieces, you get acts, you get movements, you get like all these different things that usually make up the structure of classical music. You get in Muse's pieces, which are these very, you know, massive feeling, stadium feeling. And stadium's a good word, because they very quickly were starting to perform these things to massive audiences. But there's like an importance, a bigness that a lot of Muse music comes from, because of all the production happening at once, even though it's just these like 3 really talented blokes there. So yeah, they formed together. They, in their early years at Tynemouth Community College in the 90s, they, it's funny, guitarist Matt Bellamy successfully auditioned for the drummer's band. You usually don't see that power dynamic very often.
I know, right?
We love that. And basically, the band was called Carnage Mayhem. And so Matt Bellamy became the singer and songwriter. They renamed the band to Gothic Plague. You could see where they're going here.
Great names for them, yeah.
Yeah, great names for them, not necessarily the most marketable names for what they're going to try to do. But they definitely had that aesthetic of, okay, we want to do something very dark. We want to do something very chaotic, you know, vicious, like raw, like powerful. It doesn't want to be like kind of papered over, smooth, sort of happy pop rock. This is like a really heavy kind of thing they want to do. They asked Chris Wolstenholme, at the time the drummer for a band called Fixed Penalty, to join as a bassist. He agreed and then took up bass lessons. They renamed the band Rocket Baby Dolls to do like a goth glam kind of thing. And they actually has received a 150-pound grant from like the Prince's Trust, which is basically like a Prince Charles like special program for bands and things like that. So they won Battle of the Bands. They were actually incredibly surprised because they smashed their equipment in the process and they actually won. And so they started taking themselves seriously. They quit their jobs, and that's when they changed their name to Muse, which I think is just a lot better. They said that they liked the name because it was short and looked good on a poster.
Yes.
And yeah, pretty much that. It's one of the few band marks, like the Radiohead band mark, the Gorillaz band mark, all these other different things have gone through a lot of different iterations. Of course, mm-hmm. they've sort of settled on like a couple, both bands have. The 1975, the font mark has gone through like a number of different iterations, for example.
Yeah.
Muse has been like that straight, like one line above, one line below, like THX style.
Yeah, since 99, and it hasn't changed.
Yeah, speaking of hasn't changed since 99, that THX logo. But, yeah, through that, they started releasing their first EP, playing their first gigs as you do in England, in London and Manchester. And they were slowly developing their Muse EP, which was kind of the first debut self-titled thing, which is amazing. They made just under 1,000 hand-numbered copies, I believe. And then the EP features songs that were eventually released later, Overdue, Cave, Coma, and Escape. Escape. And that was kind of like their first going out of it. They didn't release it very much, but all that stuff helped to inform their first record, which was Showbiz.
Really, really good first record. For being in 1999, like there's so many good sounds in here that they've like really established them as well. They are good. Like they are trying to push music forward, trying to push a genre forward that is coming out of the den of grunge, coming out of the den, especially in England, coming out of the Britpop era. You know, you have Blur, you have Oasis, and all these big
Park
groups.
Life.
The Gal, yeah. And you have all of this like just giant momentum, and the opening track of Sunburn on Showbiz just throws it on its head and goes tits up. I actually really like how you said it's like blending classical with alt rock and electronica and a bunch of other stuff. And it's beautiful because it just opens this beautiful piano ballad, and in the middle of it, just this big fucking crescendo. And it's like, whoa, who are these guys?
They make a statement.
Huge statement. And it's something that you get in a lot of the records are these beautiful stadium pieces that open up these records. And Sunburn is honestly one of my favorite Muse tracks. Like,
yeah.
I remember hearing that as a kid growing up, because my dad showed it to me, maybe it's got to be like 02, 03 or something. And that's one of the songs that got me into Muse was this.
It's just amazing. Like it has all of the elements of, you know, like what kids look up to at rock, especially in the 2000s, what like, you know, make games like Guitar Hero so popular, where you're just like shredding on these solos. Mm-hmm. You have like really good belting out, just like giving your heart out songs, like loud rock, like in your face drums, like it's all coming together. It's like really musically like the best parts of rock, but done in a way that is definitely alternative, but definitely very forward thinking in the year 99 when it came out too. Sunburn was such a good beginning. Sounds like Muscle Museum give you some example of what they're doing too, playing with some sense, playing with like the kind of movements and going through different things. It was such an interesting sort of like track to go into. And yeah, Muse albums are a ride. They're very interesting, but I remember going back through this record and I couldn't help but realize how of the era it is, because like you get to songs like Philip and that kind of sounds, you know, within the realm of 90s era Britpop. It's gotta be there.
it's gotta be now. All is forever. To me it is strange. This feeling is strange. But it's not gonna change for anybody. And it's gonna be our last memory. And it's
That's kind of, I think, very funny, because it's like, okay, at the end of the day, they are of their era, they are of their time, they are kind of making music that's representative of that. But you saw, like, no, we're not going to do any crowd pleasers, and we're not going to make that our first song.
Yeah, and like, example, I Hate This and I Love You, in that, again, like this beautiful ballad and stuff that doesn't fit for the time I want. And it's like, they're really, to me, this and then Origins, Symmetry, which we'll get to in a second, are the big pivots that turned grunge into alt-rock. Because you have Gorillaz, right? You have 19-2000, you have Kid A revolutionized music. But for this as like a genre, it really pushed the genre of, you know, what is rock? What does rock going to sound like in the new millennium? And this is starting to churn it and get ideas out and branch people out into using electronics, using different things to fill up stadiums. And what is the next sound going to be? Yeah. And they really pioneered that.
Yeah.
And then
Showbiz was like a massive success overall. Like,
huge success.
It got, I mean, like, it charted very, very well, which is like surprising for all involved, more or less. They were quick to, like, a lot of critics at first were kind of actually quick to dismiss the album. NME said that Showbiz is not as clever as they think it is. Unintended in the title track are overwrought, prone to being excruciatingly bad pseudo-poetry, giving it a 6 out of 10. The Rolling Stone gave the album 3 out of 5, saying Showbiz, quote, matches Tom York's penchant for majestic agony, screams, and the word self-destruction pepper, the title track, but with an edge that's quirkier and decidedly more ragged than their elders. But I think it's just a very funny quote.
That is hilarious.
Yeah. It's definitely an album that has gone, like, yeah, people have come to appreciate it more with time.
Yes.
USA Today even gave it a great review, 3 out of 4 stars in. And I will say that the topic of this Muse-like bonus episode is kind of a debate between, not between us necessarily, but like, is Muse too political, or were they not political enough, I think? Because
certain records they are, certain records they aren't. I'll just say this up right now before we get into more. Yeah.
Yeah. This album is not necessarily that political. No. And like, and I'm not going to, you know, too political, not political enough. It's not like they have to make political things. But Muse, it's hard to kind of like mention Muse without mentioning their political leanings and what they're talking about. In fact, you basically can't. That's like Rage Against the Machine. What do you mean that's political? It's like basically up the same realm with Muse. So, we'll be getting that very soon. But yeah, overall, Showbiz was a good first effort, really solid, and you could definitely very easily see what the band was coming into. And then they in the production, like working on their second album, the wonderful, brilliant Origin of Symmetry, Muse started experimenting with church organs, animal bones, arpeggiated guitars, all these other different things to, you know, really kind of reinvent their sound and try to do something else. And with that, you got like one of the classics of 2000s alternative rock.
Yep. Origin of Symmetry is one of these records that I was glad when we got to do the Muse bonus episode because I got to listen back to it. I haven't listened to it in a little while. I used to listen to it a ton.
Religiously in my younger school, years. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was crazy when I was like, I forgot how many good tracks are on Origin of the Symmetry. Because fun fact for me, when I had this on CD, my CD got fucked up, so I didn't listen to Origin of the Symmetry for like 5 years or something. Like, I could listen to about like 6 songs on here, and then it was like after I think Citizen Erased, it just was My CD was shit. So I didn't get to listen to the second half of the record for like 5-6 years until like the iTunes came out. And then that was one of the first records I bought, was that. And because I was like, I want to finally get this other half of the record. And even now revisiting it, I go, my God, there is so much good in here. And this is, to me, as you said, this is where it's like, this is alternative rock.
Yeah.
Like 100%. This is where they get political, you know, like this is where they really get into the air of like talking about a bunch of different stuff.
And their political themes are, you know, to say, you know, 1984 is so overused as like a reference to things right now. It oftentimes is used in the wrong way. But yeah, it's like dystopia. It's government overreach and control. It's people turning against each other. Yeah, the overreach of technology. All these different themes pop in and out, sometimes in more focused ways, sometimes in more loose ways. The military-industrial complex. This Muse definitely goes in on that. But it's definitely a lot of things that liberals, leftists would appreciate and care about.
Yes, exactly. And it's like Origins Symmetry opens up with Newborn, which is just this really nice alt-rock ballad of just hard-hitting rock, gets you really into it, almost like Arctic Monkeys-ish sounding, with how I'd say, and I really like that. And then Bliss, you get this track, and it's this beautiful piano ballad, and I'm like, only Muse sounds like this.
Everything about you pains my envy. You're so can't-hated through. Everything about you is so easy to love.
No other group sounds like that at all. And it's just this beautiful blend of electronica with alt rock, that beautiful piano at the beginning, and just it's just like it's so unique.
I can't help but feel, especially just because of the era that's coming out in, the little synth thing that's going on in the background. It's a very simple like,
but
it feels like Daft Punk inspired, even like just because of what was out in that era. Like it can't help but feel like it has that sort of flair, like that nod, so to speak. But
yeah, I mean, because like it's, you know, that came out in 2001. I think it was out all before that. You know, you have a lot of, they're inspired by a lot of, you know, the dawns of electronic. You have Kid A, right? That comes out a year and a half before that. And they were inspired by Radiohead too. So there's a lot of different things where they're trying different sounds, experimenting. And then all those experimentings are hitting and you get just this wonderful record. Even example, like their harder hitting songs, Hyper Music, Plug and Baby, where they're like really hard alt rock, they still like fit within the record because of the themes and Matt Bellamy's voice. It's just beautiful throughout it too. And he even tries experimenting, he like yells into it and has different vocal tricks and things he uses to make it more harder hitting, but it still is really good for the whole record. You have Citizen Erase in the middle of it, which is beautiful. Love and that. Just, yeah, I love that track.
It's definitely really when they're like, getting political as well, yeah.
Super. And one track that, you know, I missed for 5 years before I finally got to buy the record again was Dark Shines.
I have my bass bias really, with it, of course, but yeah, go on.
Of course. And to me, this is where I like to say that Chris is a damn good bass player, you know? As someone who, I appreciate good bass lines too, but I never really played bass that much. I was always very impressed when when you had a guitar and bass to where they complemented each other and not one wasn't pulling one from the other too hard, where it's just this beautiful cohesion. And Darkshine does that with this really nice, like 50 sounding Telecaster that you get on there. It's twangy, it's westernish sounding, but the drum on there keeps it in the new millennia. And that's what I love about that song.
What I love about Darkshine's, I mean, I've gone through so many different phases with that song. It's a very understated track, but it's like really one of my favorites on Origin of Symmetry, even though it wasn't one of the singles at all. It's near the end of it. But near the middle of the song, you would almost be fooled into believing it's like the song winding down or breaking in, so to speak, or like ending. But it's almost breaks down from like this heavy rock, like bassy thing into jazz almost. Like it's something you'd hear like at a, like a jazz club, like really kind of like quiet. Just like and the bass line just doing a kind of really muted, instead of the picking and like slapping thing, just kind of strumming it over the notes, like do 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 do. It's such a lovely kind of like groove to it. And then the song feels like it fades away into the distance, almost like a beach at sunset, and then just rings in for that crescendo near the end with just the belting vocals. It's such a beautiful only Muse. It's once again an only Muse kind of track where you just take a couple of elemental things and just combine them together to make something absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm. It's just such a good second LP. Again, you always get that, what we like to call it, the second album curse. As Robin Peck, known to Fleet Foxes, says, thank God I'll never have to make a second record again, because it's very difficult to do. And for them, with all of the like the praises and the critiques they've gotten, they just didn't listen to any of that and kept true to themselves as artists and really made alt rock be alt rock. And it's such a good album. It's still, you know, I think for most of their records, you know, it stays the test of time. So
I love one fun fact on here is that, so yeah, all the critics did a complete about face. NME, who had originally said that the record, you know, like lacked a lot of things and was sort of like amateurish, eventually turned around and gave Origin, like they said that about Showbiz. They turned around about Origin and Symmetry and said it's amazing for such a young band to load up with a heritage that includes the darker versions of Cobain and Kafka, Mahler, the Tiger Lilies, Cronenberg, and Schoenberg, and made a sexy populist album. My favorite fun fact here is that apparently Maverick, which was Muse's record label in America, did not consider Bellamy's vocals radio friendly enough and asked him to record the song, and they were asked to re-record Hyper Music and Feeling Good, basically with different vocals. And Muse was like, all right, okay, we quit. And just left the record label immediately.
Fucking brilliant. I love it.
And so
that's good. Stay true to yourself as an artist.
Because of that, the album wasn't released in the US until like 2005. So yeah, that was just so weird. It was like madly delayed because of that. Yeah, but everyone really loved it.
That actually makes sense of why I got that record when I did then. I didn't know that it was delayed like that. Because also in my head, like early days before like I could look it up, I always thought Absolution was their second record. And now I understand why. Because I got that had to have been like 05, 06 when it was released.
You know what?
When I got this CD.
That's like a Berenstain Bears thing in my head too, because I actually always think of Absolution as being the second record, even though I definitely had like the English version of Muse's Origin of Symmetry.
I didn't have it because I didn't really listen to Muse until 2005, 2006, I would say.
Super fair.
Right before Black Ops Revelations came out, like 2 years before that record came out.
Yeah.
I started listening. Yeah.
Absolution came out, and I originally didn't, when like it first came out, however we heard it, whatever order we heard it, I thought that it was almost too leaning into the rock elements and the aspects of it, and almost too heavy-handed with the politics that was coming into it. But on my second listen, but that's how I saw it when I was younger, so to speak. I felt like songs like When You Begin with Time Is Running Out, even the one of the bigger tracks on Stockholm Syndrome. felt like those were just, whereas Origin of Symmetry and other records that Muse was about to release did a lot with a little in a lot of cases, like the Billie Eilish pop thing where you describe where you're taking out elements of music and you're letting those like really kind of sing on their own, so to speak. That's what I'd felt like Muse was doing a lot of. I felt like with Absolution, Muse was just throwing a lot of sound at it. And for me, as someone where it's like I wasn't that into heavy rock as a kid, I went through phases of it. I didn't like Absolution when I was going to Muse fixes. Like for me, what did it for Muse were other albums. But then again, for doing this version of this podcast, I was able to actually really enjoy not even just the sound of it, but the political messages that are in it as well.
And for me, Absolution is one of those records that really defined my childhood. This in Origin, the Symmetry, I listened to a lot in primary school going into junior high, with tracks like Time Is Running Out, Apocalypse Please, Scene for Absolution. Those first three tracks I listened to a lot, especially Time Is Running Out. Still probably my favorite Muse track. That and Starlight, more on that later. I listened to it a lot, and that to me is like the epitome of aughts alternative rock is that sound. I remember going to baseball games and a bunch of stuff, listening to that song a ton. And you have tracks like Hysteria, Blackout, Butterflies and Hurricanes towards like the end of the record that are really good with what they do with the electronics on there, where they like have that little as I like to say throughout it, where it's just really messing with the keyboards and trying doing different things with that sound. But with this record, to me, this like establishes what does Muse sound like. You now have three records with them, and to me, they have found their sound. They have found like, okay, we are alt rock with electronica and a lot of different sounds that fill up stadiums, that Matt Bellamy's voice just explodes onto the scene and all of that. And with that, they've established themselves as just hitting bangers after bangers after bangers and all of that. So, wow. I really like this album. It's hard. There's, because it means so much to me, it might be my favorite Muse album. It's either this or Black Holes Revelations. It kind of depends what mood I'm in. But to me, it's one of the records that really defined my taste in music. Because it got me to experiment a little bit more with the harder rock stuff, because I never really liked it. Like here or there, I wouldn't mind it. But with like Stockholm Syndrome and Hysteria, like those tracks, I was like, oh wow, let me get into some of the other stuff. Origin of the Symmetry, and I was like, oh cool, now and then with that, because backwards mind of the day, because I didn't know when these albums came out, I was like, oh wow, this is a really cool third record, didn't know that.
Yeah,
so
I, for me, coming back to it, it's like what I got me into harder music and rock was ultimately stuff like Tool or Hollywood Undead or things like that.
Also Rage Against the Machine for me too, but
absolutely. But I guess for Muse, I was had in my head like what Muse kind of was. And so certain things didn't like hit for me back then. But I, going back to, especially with age, I love Hysteria so much. I love like Stockholm Syndrome, I liked as a kid. Like that's basically my favorite song off of this, one of the few that I liked. But yeah, going through this, you really get that the stadium feeling, the orchestral kind of, okay, this is like a massive project. Like all these things are kind of coming together. We're not just doing like a simple 4-4 time structure. Now we're going to like have all this stuff collide and be chaotic and bring this big building moment that's like partially unexpected, but partially like the culmination of everything they're doing in that record. You also get the beginnings of what I think are just the less collection of songs that Muse is doing, which is, you know, a lot of like what alternative rock albums were, and more like, okay, we have a form of how we want these albums to flow and function, because it's like a, you know, it's these are acts, these are musical pieces. It's kind of what Muse was naturally going towards anyways. And you start to see, I feel like, the beginnings of that in this record. There's sort of cohesive themes in there. Like, of course, Stockholm Syndrome is kind of very... A lot of these, Muse is not the most subtle, let's say, with their political messaging. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these kind of just tell themselves, Thoughts of a Dying Atheist, for example. But I think they're beautiful, heavy-hitting tracks, especially having listened to them. But I think this album, Muse had a lot of like game-changer moments, I believe. And I think this is one of those things where I felt that Black Holes and Revelations was like their game changer moment, but that's because I was experiencing Muse in England. Whereas I came to America, and like that was part of why we became friends, was like, what? Where are the Muse posters? Like, is Muse not like the biggest band in the world? And like to you and I, like they were. And it wasn't until the album that came after this where it was that felt like that in America. But the album that did that in England was definitely Black Holes and Revelations.
100%. By far. And to me, this is songs on here I listen to on repeat, like growing up.
So does the radio.
Yeah, and so does the radio. But songs are not even on the radio that I would listen to a lot. I would sit on the computer playing random shit from the dawn of like online play and stuff of video games. This is right when the Xbox 360 came out, and I remember playing Halo 3 when it was out. And I remember listening to like Assassin, Exopolitics, Hoodoo, Nice of Sidonia, a shit ton.
Oh yeah, these are on my
online games. Yeah,
these were on my Pandora playlist while I was playing Killzone 3 on my new PlayStation 3.
There you go. But I remember I had to download that shit on a CD onto my Xbox, and it was a pain in the ass to do it, but I just really wanted to listen to it while I was playing games, and I was super stoked when I finally got it to work.
Yeah. The ideas behind Black Holes and Revelations, this was definitely Muse's most like conceptiest record ever. It cements Muse's like, okay, we're really doing this. It's about dystopia. You look at the album cover, and I think it's really hard to tell. Cool. It's probably my favorite Muse album cover because it looks
one
like
of my favorite album covers of all time.
Yeah, honestly, like it's just so hard. There's like having like the Last Supper, so to speak, like on the red planet, like on Mars. And yeah,
on Mars, it looks like Mars's Grand Canyon.
Yeah,
it's really cool.
It's a very themed with outer space, like people kind of abandoning Earth to go to something else. It has a lot of themes with political strife and turmoil leading into that. And this is an Iraq war record. This is a record that comes out of the context of a lot of geopolitical strife where America and England were leading a lot of that. And they were a very vocal part of the population. Not as vocal as they were, you know, 2003, 2004. But by 05 or 06, a lot of people were like, this war is dumb and we don't want it to be going on. And so Black Holes and Revelations came at a great time. It was the right kind of Muse mix of hitting you over the head with politics, but I think it was just hit the moment at the right time. To get into this bastard, like Take a Bow is still a song they will sometimes close to when they perform live. And I think it's just an amazing sort of like
beautiful song.
Build up. Starlight. It's one of those songs where it's produced in such like a key it's unusually like major and kind of unusual for a band like Muse to do. And so it's a little bit, I don't know, it always evokes a reaction to me, similar to El Manana on Demon Days, where it's sort of like very emotionally happy and full of a lot of joy, even though it has like a, it has a juxtaposition. Like one of the biggest lyrics is in Starlight is, no one cares if you live or die, but it's this like happy kind of joyous song. And that contrast, that melancholy, like we all know, Dan loves that shit. when you take a pop record that's very happy and make it about like dark political turmoil.
Yep. It's just beautiful, beautiful track. I had that on repeat as a kid. Love listening to it a lot. I really like how the keyboard sounded on it too, where it was, I don't know what effect they're using on it, but it sounds like it's getting hit like four times in a row when you're hitting it. Like the way it's layered when you really listen to it closely. I remember listening to that, like growing up, having it on my headphones. It's like, how did they make that sound like that? Like, what layering did they do with it to give it that effect? It's very, very subtle. But if you listen to it closely, you can hear that aspect. And it's something there I'm like, what exactly is it doing? And it's one of those songs that opened up my curiosity of music production. It was one of the early things of how was this made. Usually I would just listen to a track and like it. But this is one of those where I remember distinctively looking up on like on the internet and everything and seeing how did they make this. I can never really find an answer. But now, like, you know, 16 years later or whatever, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. I understand how it's done. Like, okay, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But beautiful, beautiful track. All right, after that, Supermassive Black Hole, a track, and I think this is the track that you and I actually got along with, the Supermassive Black Hole. Listening to this, I remember you saying, oh, I like Muse, and I'm like,
yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Good man. How do you do?
Exactly, how do you do?
Yeah, because like we have a very storied first day of friendship, and so from there there's nowhere to go but up, and so we eventually found out that Muse was a thing. And no, that was great. Muse was also like one of those songs I was happy to hear played constantly on American radio.
Yes,
at one point. Yeah. I distinctly remember field trips in high school where Supermassive Black Hole was like playing on the radio, and like everyone knew all the lyrics to it and was like belting all the different shit. And like,
we were singing that. Yeah.
We were in a particularly like artsy musician type of corner of the school, and so we had people doing like different parts of the songs. Like, my favorite part is the backing vocals in this, actually. Like, of course, I love the bass, of course, I love the
Jake
wailing and the singing.
Alive.
But the wishes melting in the dead of night. I love that part. It's a really good just blending of everything. And it's just a well-executed song because this is meant to be a rock alternative banger. Your song two or your song three on an album, like Muse did here, song two and song three, check, are your singles. They're your heavy-hitting things. They need to convince everyone to listen to the rest of the album. If they weren't sold on Take a Bow, which would sell a lot of people, like even though it's not music, like, of course, we Muse has, but like, sold me already. Starlight would sell you. Supermassive Black Hole would, like, triple deluxe, like, lock you to the bed, like, you're good.
Yeah, it's just one of the best alternative rock records ever made.
Period. Like, full stop.
Period. It's just...
And Muse has, like, a good 4 or 5 under their belt, too.
They really do. And it's like, to me, this is the epitome of what you could do as a three-piece group that have so many ideas, make it cohesive, make it political without being like way too out there, like craziness, to where it can still have that mainstream radio play, but it still sounds fresh. It still sounds modern and new. Even when like looking back onto this record, it's like, dude, I could listen to this every day and be happy.
Oh, yeah. This is one of those desert island, you only pick one kind of albums, and like you could do some good work with this.
You really could.
Yeah. Probably not a lot of sleeping, but still, it's some good work here. And so I will also say one thing just to counter a point to underline a point we always make on Audio Face. This was the first Muse record that had no deadline. This is the first Muse record where they like specifically said, we're not making any distractions. We're actually going to take an active role in the production and the technology aspects of things. And we're going to carefully and methodically craft our record so that it is the best representation of the art we want to put out there. That's how you do it.
Fucking did it.
Results. It gets results.
Use this as the Audio Face 16 years before Audio Face is, or 10 years before Audio Face is made.
That's a fact. Alex Jones voice. But yeah, throughout the middle of the record, really like the middle of the record, because of like the bangers and Starlight and Supermassive Black Hole, the middle of the record's often looked over, but you have some really like great Muse deep cuts here that I really love. Like Map of the Problematique is, of course, after that. Exopolitics is one of my favorites. Saved Illusion is great in there. Hoodoo, my favorite map in Team Fortress 2. And Knights of Cydonia as well.
Knights of Cydonia is such a cool track because it's a two-part track.
Yeah.
I love two-part tracks.
Knights of Cydonia, you really start to get like, this is another direction Muse goes into of just taking their orchestral alternative rock to like brand new heights of grandeur, so to speak. Like mm-hmm. this is just like grand, big, it fills a room kind of production that is extremely thoughtful. The Knights of Cydonia is meant to invoke the idea of the fourth horseman of the apocalypse and like the idea of the invincible, and the fact that it's kind of coming at the end of an album called Black Holes and Revelations, signifying all of this chaos that's happening coming to like a vacuumed out like end. Very thoughtful. And again, this is what I'm telling you, Muse is getting really thoughtful with how they lay out their records and the story that they're telling and the concepts they are. I love concept records. This is one of my favorite concept records of all time. It's one of my favorite alternative records of all time. If we, you know, invent more hours in the day or months in the year and we get around to doing 50 of the thousands, this was definitely going to be on that list.
50 of the thousands, Lord help me.
That'd be the hardest list of all time, man.
I gotta deal with like Odds Bjork. Shit, dude.
That's not
fair.
that top 10 would probably cause the first argument we've had in like 15 years.
I think it would. Like we'd have to arm wrestle on some of like we have the rock paper scissors for like the top 3.
Turkish oil wrestling.
Coleslaw wrestling.
Cenk Uygur versus Dr. Oz. 3 rounds scrimmage.
Due to the conditions of my parole, the number one record is.
Anyways, but Black Holes and Revelations launched Muse on a, again, big in Europe, a 2-year tour, one of the biggest ones they've ever done, and really made them big. But yeah, for some reason, it was at the point where Muse just, they definitely were known in America for sure. And the alternative rock stations were heavy rotation for songs like Starlight, Supermassive, Black Hole, Knights of Cydonia, of course. But they didn't quite have that, you know, like universal sort of cachet where like everyone knows about them. So Muse was like, all right, bet. And then I really kind of just want to get into the recording of this because before releasing the fifth album, The Resistance, which might be Muse's largest record, Wolstenholme talks about checking into rehab to deal with his alcoholism, which was threatening the band's future. And so they talked about being together for half their lives and growing up through all this thing and all the work that had gone into it and how, yeah, it was very, it was a lot of work they wanted to do into it, that a lot of the ideas they had, but also a lot of reconciling that they had to do with themselves as artists. They wanted to kind of translate these ideas, but also they want to transcend as artists. There's a lot of really fun ideas. They said at one point NME was reporting that they were planning an electronic album that was going to include a 15-minute space rock solo and that it would challenge the conventional format of the album. I mean, this is coming out at the same time of In Rainbow, so like it's almost like postmodernism for albums at that point. Like the idea of an album and a concept as in a response to iTunes and digital music purchases and
hey, what piracy. You want? Here you go.
Yeah. This was all, these things were all kind of in the air. Apparently Rick Rubin was hired to produce the album, but he was they scrapped the Rick Rubin recordings of the album because they weren't good enough. I will repeat that. Muse scrapped the Rick Rubin recordings of The Resistance because it wasn't good enough. I have qualms about like producers all the time. I feel like you have some like wins and some losses. Rick Rubin? What?
But that's just saying, like, they know what they want. They knew what they wanted to make a record sound. And sometimes you have to take that. Like, you know, I'm looking at you, people who have songs produced by Jack Antonoff. If it doesn't fit in the record, release as a B-side or cut it all together, goddammit.
In the lead up to the release, Christopher Wolstenholme said, "I don't think there's anything we're ready to record yet. We just wanted to get this album started this year, get the ball rolling." Basically saying that, oh yeah, rather than wait for a year and do nothing. But I love this quote. Wait, Bellamy apparently said during an award show, he thanked Rick Rubin for teaching us how not to produce. Jesus Christ.
Shit, dude.
Yeah, but I mean, it goes to show like this is a very difficult musical process. He told fans, don't expect new Muse very soon. But the album ultimately came out in 2009 and it essentially became like a massive, like huge. Like I wasn't expecting
played
it.
Played everywhere.
To the point where we both got annoyed. Like,
no, exactly. Like example, the opening track, Uprising. Beautiful, yeah. Really, really good track. But it was overplayed to hell because of how big it, like, TV shows were using it. Like, it just exploded in a way that I never thought a Muse track would have just exploded onto the scene. Like, I did not expect to have that much appeal to the U.S. market.
Yeah, alternative music was having a time. I mean, like, Radiohead's 15 Step was in Twilight around the same time. Like, so there were a lot of
Arctic Monkeys was starting to get a little bit bigger too with some of their tracks as well, and there's a lot for alt rock.
Uprising also had a moment because it came out at a time when you had a lot of different uprisings around the world, and its lyrics very easy to translate out of English. They will not force us; we will be victorious. All these other different things. I mean, like again, Muse is never. I'm doing a lot less work here. I feel as Dan from the Internet, the political person, explaining the political themes of Muse because. Fucking read any of the lyrics.
Read it. It's pretty simple.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just go through some now, like for the sake of it. But like, the uprising starts with paranoia is in bloom. The PR transmissions will resume. They'll try to push drugs to keep us all dumbed down and hope that we'll never see the truth around. Like, I don't need to analyze that. Okay. Like,
we know what that
it's
means.
Just there. And but like, the fact that this had a like mainstream appeal kind of song to the point where like this track was played in elevators at like Goldman Sachs, like, it just kind of blurred into the background to the point where like it almost meant nothing. But it was like a big song that was used during the Occupy movements that happened very shortly after that because it was a very economically tumultuous time for a lot of people when they were feeling like fucking shit up.
Right after the financial crash, because 2009, like it's a few months after the... mortgage crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis. So,
yeah. After that, you have the song Resistance. Which goes back to this, like, they are making rock opera, so to speak. Like, it is very massive. It has, like, a meaning to it. I actually didn't like this song a lot when it came out, just because I was in just, like, the heavy rock, like, go into it. But you do kind of appreciate, like, damn, they really just did make their, like, single and their, like, title track this impressive and this amazing with, like, this much mainstream appeal, and it's musically complicated. Like, if anything, I'm realizing in retrospect, Muse did a lot of what we, like, you know, we kind of just assume is impossible. Like, oh, you can't make a hard rock album that's, like, has themes of classical music that is hard, hard, hard politics and have it be essentially pop music. And Muse was like, yeah, we can. We did. easily.
We did. We made a whole record of it, damn it.
Yeah. Undisclosed Desires is the third song. It's my favorite Muse song, period. We were talking about it before the show and we were like, actually, no contest. I love the bass for it. It's definitely like one of the more like sensual, like love kind of songs Muse does, but it still has like a political bent to it. It's kind of amazing in it as well. And I think just like the refrain to it, I want to reconcile the violence in your heart. I want to recognize your beauty's not just a mask, is like, again, really kind of groundbreaking stuff to make in a pop record of like, addressing like traumas and opinions about like how society has beauty standards and all these other different things in a rock record like this at this mainstream level, and make it like a sexy bop. Like, and Muse is like, all right, track three, next.
Yeah.
They, I guess I feel like at one point, every artist makes some record where like, okay, we're just going to make the best album we can so we don't have this chip on our shoulder for the rest of our careers. We don't need to keep like working towards this. Let's just make it and then have fun. Let's do all the side missions after this. But this really was like, this is what would make a 50 of the 10s like best albums so difficult, especially because we tried not to do repeats in it. And you have to have Resistance. And you have to have Black Holes and Revelations. And I make a strong case for Origins of Symmetry, too.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I got. 50 the Aughts would... 50 the Aughts would be so fucking hard.
Yeah.
God, I'm glad we had to do that one.
Yeah.
I don't think I could. I really don't think I could. Because I already know Kid A's number one. Like, you can't fucking tell me no. But then you have, like... all these Muse records, you have like Cigarettes records, you have Incubus records, like you have so much good fucking music. It's just impossible.
Yeah.
But the thing with the Resistance, where I start to get issues with Muse and some of the way they make their latter records, is towards the middle of it, you actually have some good stuff with MK Ultra and A Natural Selection, but then the last four tracks, I Belong to You, and then those Exogenesis Symphonies Part 1, 2, and 3. It's just very out there and kind of odd with how it is. And I never really got into it. And even on like my next time, like kind of going back now, retrospectively looking at it, it still for me is like, it's okay. I understand and see what they're trying to do with it. But for me, just with how pop rock-ish they make it sounding for the first three, four tracks, with that having that end with like the part three symphony is just really odd of how it's done.
Yeah, I think... What I like about Muse is that they have the idea that they want to take classical music and rock music and really elevate it to this level. But I believe they do that on a mainstream like kind of basis, right? Like they did that and they achieved that on you know, their songs before the Resistance and the songs that come on the Resistance on here, especially the first three. So I feel like they do a lot of showing, not telling. Which is funny for a band like Muse, which like literally has like such on the nose political lyrics and things like that, where you know it's very obvious what they're talking about. But I feel like this Exogenesis thing is an example of them telling, where they're like, no, we are literally going to make a classical like music style rock opera thing with three parts. And it's like, yeah, at their worst, Muse hits you over the head with their ideas and they get very full of themselves about their like ideas and how good they are. And on the one hand, yes, as an example of it, it still sits there as that. It makes the Resistance as an album not feel like the most like easy, oh, we can just like hand it to them kind of deal. On the other hand, They kind of earned it. They completely fucking earned it. And even if I don't like it, I mean, like, it's almost like you have to nerf an album this good, right? You have to give it something that makes, like, a little bit, like, standing. Otherwise, mm-hmm. like, it would have been just, like, orgasmically too great. But, like, The Resistance was massive. They toured everywhere. It was, like, a massive part about them. And I will say, Exogenesis, I think, does translate a lot better live. So there's that.
Oh, yeah.
But so many awards. Based on having the largest airplay in sales in the United States, Muse were named Billboard Alternative Songs and Rock Songs Artist for 2010. And then they supported Rage Against the Machine at their only 2011 gig at the LA Rising Festival. So it was, Muse's big moment in the United States. And to achieve mainstream success in the United States is really like the musician's holy grail, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
The international musician's holy grail. The second law is where things get interesting when you go from the Resistance to the second law. There's a massive gap in the time in between Resistance and the second law, which makes sense, of course, because this was Resistance was such a project, it was such a big deal for them that they toured the hell out of it. They had to relax and then recuperate mm-hmm. and then do what they do, which is we're going to make music on our sweet ass time and we're going to make what we really want to do. So they said outwardly that their album The Second Law would be influenced by French house duo Justice and UK electronic rock group Does Defend You, yeah. Which are really great kind of backgrounds, like ideas from it.
Yeah.
And then we got the first single from it, which was Madness. Oh, no, that wasn't the first single. It was Survival.
Survival.
Yes. Which was like tied into the Olympics for some reason. I totally forget.
Yes. Yeah, because they opened. It was the opening song for the Olympics, the 2012 London.
To stay alive, I won't forgive. Vengeance is mine.
And it was just a really cool rock ballad thing that was really like pretty appropriate for the Olympics, I would say. But like kind of looking back at it, like this sounds like 2012. Like the thing with this record that I have now looked back on is this, the second law is a sound that is in a time capsule. Like,
yeah.
Like the equivalent I'll give it to is like A Brief Inquiry into Online Relationships by The Unseen Survive is a bubble of 2018 sound, but there are some songs from there that really like can still shine today. With The Second Law, really it's like Madness, maybe Panic Station, you can still kind of ish play now. The rest of the record, actually I think there's some really understated songs in there, more on that a little bit. The rest of the record is really like, this is the sound of, you know, early tens.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't have the longevity of their previous records at all.
And that's exactly like what I originally didn't like with it. Survival was sort of like, okay, I see what you're doing here. But I mean, after absolutely orgasm and spoiling the world with The Resistance, it definitely didn't feel like the right, you know, coming back to it. The second single, Madness, that won me back around.
Look back at all the crazy fights we had. It's like some kind of madness was taking control.
I definitely love that. I thought it was a really good...
And this is a really good song.
It felt really like the natural, like, you know, the Demon Days to Plastic Beach, sort of like natural evolution of Muse's sound from The Resistance. And I was like, oh, maybe the album sounds a little bit more like this. And ultimately what you got from The Second Law was a little bit all over the place to some extent, because I think the first three songs, like Supremacy, Madness, and Panic Station, are three totally different sounds. And like the album doesn't necessarily pick that, like, which of those sounds it's going to be throughout the whole thing, nor does it commit to the kind of cohesion you almost want to suspect from a Muse record, especially at this point, especially having, okay, you did like a rock ballad, like a rock opera, like the last record. Apparently you care about cohesion, doing all this stuff. So I was expecting more of that. I didn't get it. Here's where I'm thinking I'm going to surprise you, song. Sean, I like The Second Law now. I do, honestly, because I think as a record and as like, as for what it is, a time capsule, listening to it back again, I like it back a second listen. I actually do like everything past the prelude, which is basically when I used to just like, okay, I kind of just give up with this record.
And that's what a lot of people did, like in high school, like Justin and a couple of other friends, they just gave up. And I'm like, dude, Follow Me is a damn good song. Save Me is incredible, beautiful, Joe. One of the most beautiful understated Muse tracks. Chris, the bass player, is the one who's doing the vocals on the whole track. It's incredible. And it's a really good live song, too. And I've been telling people, I'm like, God damn it, this record is good. It doesn't hold up because it's such a time capsule. So for me, but there's still some good songs in here. Explorers, Animals, Save Me. Like some of those tracks, I'm like, damn, they're beautiful. It's just the shitty part of The Second Law is it's not cohesive. It is not a cohesive record. It's not a cohesive project at all. But there are beautiful tracks on here that I really enjoy and I still listen to every once in a while.
I even think that the two tracks, the end, The Second Law, Unsustainable and Isolated System, I think that's a better attempt at the sort of, you know, rock ballad type of thing than Exogenesis.
I called it Muse Step and when it came out.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's
definitely way, it's definitely better than what the Resistance did, though, for sure.
Yeah. It has a balance to it. It definitely felt like 2012 and 2013 by, being like very Muse Steppy and that, like dubsteppy in that thing. But the song I just keep going back to is Panic Station. It's almost like the when Drake released Honestly Nevermind, it was a very polarizing record. And then Jimmy Cooks or whatever the hell was the song that was like thrown at the very end to be like, hey, it's me, Drake, I'm still here. Panic Station kind of felt like that. It's like, hey, it's Muse, we're still here. Like, we can still make songs like that. But it was weird because I very much, you know, typical Audioface fashion, it was still like this back before there was a podcast. I didn't want a band to necessarily make the same thing they had just made or a repeat type things, right? I wanted them to evolve, but this just felt like, you know, I really wanted to ride with them. I really wanted to ride with what they were doing, but they just couldn't pick a thing for me to ride with. And I felt like, you know, it was the first Muse album in honestly a decade where I just was like, wow, is the run over? I guess it is. Because it was definitely kind of like weird. I'm interested to see how you feel about the later two records, because now we're kind of getting into more recent times. Remember, I don't know if we reviewed all of, we didn't review Drones because we couldn't have.
We didn't review Drones because we didn't, but then Simulation Theory, we definitely reviewed.
Yeah.
So going on to that, well, with The Second Law, you actually had a huge tour where they were selling out stadiums and stuff. And to me, this is when Muse was at their biggest, was around this era where, like, the 2012 era where they were just like, to me, the two biggest bands at the time were Coldplay and Muse. Like, they were the ones, like, just selling out arenas.
They were stadium rock, yes.
Like, stadium rock, exactly.
Whereas Coldplay, like, see also the What Happened to Coldplay episode of Audioface that people really love. But like Muse really felt like from the beginning, they were making music built for stadiums. Like it has had to have this type of big thing.
Exactly.
They had their fourth live album recorded during this time. It was the first live album to be filmed in 4K. It was done at the Stadio Olimpico in Rome. It was, yeah, 60,000 people were watching this over the entire thing. It's
absurd.
Absolutely, like,
massive.
Yeah. I think in Rolling Stone, when The Second Law was put as the 46th out of 50th best albums of 2012, which I think that's fair enough.
Fair. 2012 and, actually had a good, yeah. a lot of good music.
In an era of diminished expectations, Muse makes stadium-crushing songs that mix the legacies of Queen, King Crimson, and Led Zeppelin, and Radiohead, while making almost every other current band seem tiny. And that's true. Even at their worst, Muse just felt like it was on a different level.
It really did. And to me, where for me, I started to get really critical of their music and seeing like the structure of their records was Drones. 2015 comes out. They revert, I think, because maybe of all of the criticism they got of The Second Law and stuff, and them trying to figure out like
their white
sound they wanted to make and everything. Yeah, because I know they recorded it right after they did the live version of Rome.
Yeah, or did the live Rome concert? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And with that, like the. If, I know they didn't want to. I remember listening to interviews and stuff on MBE because this was my Jason Bentley days. Ah, I miss those days.
He still does some DJ sets in LA. We got to go to one.
Dude, and they're fucking good. Like, yeah, we super have to go to one. I watched one live stream. Damn good. That's with a separate tangent.
With the time and money that we have. But
exactly. But with Drones, they said actively, like, okay, we think we're relying too heavy on our electronic side and stuff. So they wanted to strip it back. Like they were saying, hey, like we want to return to like a sound that we had before, but like more of a simple sound where we're just playing our instruments and stuff. And but the biggest thing that was interesting to me, I don't know who produced the record. I have to look it up. But they produced their last two records just themselves. And with this, with Drones, they hired people to go and do it because they wanted to do like focus on like playing their stuff. Instead of going back and having to do the whole process of recording and doing it all themselves, which I thought was interesting when I heard that in interviews.
Yeah. The producer, the one they did hire, was Robert John Lunge, also known as Mutt. He's worked with folks like AC/DC, Lady Gaga, Nickelback, Huey Lewis and the News, Billy Ocean, Boomtown Rats, Britney Spears, Maroon 5, Def Leppard, AC/DC. Yeah. So he's very, very good. Basically, I'd say rock, country, and pop are the sort of like realms of expertise. But yeah, also in a truly Muse going back to basics form, this is a like hard-hitting political concept record. And like it's hitting you over the head with it. It's about the dehumanization of warfare and how technology is allowing people to separate themselves from the, you know, horrors of war, the killing, the actual moral decision-making of all that kind of stuff. You see that with like the album cover, of course, in the most Muse obvious kind of way. Person controlling a bunch of people moving in a line in order with a joystick, but that person also has a bigger joystick. Very, very classic Muse imagery. And this was a Goldilocks thing where I think it was like, you know, if Muse were listening to me, this would be like a, I'd be the annoying music critic thing. But whereas Second Law was too different of a step, like too much of a sidestep for Muse, for me, Drones was like, okay, you're going too much back into like your old stuff to the point where it's like, okay, in 2015, when Drones came out, again, there were songs in here I really love. Dead Inside, phenomenal first track. And really made me feel like, oh shit, Muse is, we finally like aligned the X and Y axis on this perfectly. Dead Inside feels like a modern song that's inspired by Black Holes and Revelations Muse, but with the right amount of electronics from the Second Law and the Resistance coming together into a beautiful thing that's like really built up and powerful. Psycho, I just love the lyrics too in the beginning. Your ass belongs to me now.
psycho killer!
I am a psycho killer!
Scream it!
I love all the little like drill sergeant stuff in there. It really helps to define the albums as a motif, so to speak. But yeah, it's like it was the second kind of case in a row with a Muse record where, like, after the first couple songs, I kind of fell off into the concept. And going back to it now, I enjoy it a lot more, like, as a record. I think it's like a fine record. But yeah, I just miss old Muse where they were just like delivering banger after banger every single track. And I just like loved it that way. And it was songs I kept coming back to.
Yeah, for me, just it was, I didn't like how they pivoted back to just doing with just instruments the whole way. I wanted to have a little bit more electronic stuff, because the thing with me with electronics is you could do so much with it. But I think that they didn't want to rely on it too much and stuff. And with that, is it just sounded dated with drones. Obviously Psycho and a couple other tracks I thought were really cool, but I remember listening to it fully then, and then it, going back to it now, I still have the same opinion where it's just, it got to be pretty bland towards like after track 4 or 5. It just was at one level and it stayed at that level the whole way. And that was my big issue with the record. And that's, I was like, man, all right, maybe that's it. Maybe let's see what happens. Because after the second, I really liked the second law when it came out. I still do like it, but it's just not as cohesive as a project. And with that, I was like, God damn it, don't do the inverse Coldplay and revert back to your old sound. But then after that record, they had some time and stuff. And what was interesting with the history of this podcast, Simulation Theory came out 2018, but the first single, Dig Down, came out like the week we made the podcast.
Okay, welcome. Hello, humans. Welcome to the Audio Face podcast, the one and only podcast for now on the Syndicate 23 network. I am Dan Evans Nakamura, aka Dan from the internet, joined by my friend Sean Suarez.
Yep, Sean.
Yes, you are.
Yeah. I don't know, like, how to plug.
You've got a little bit on Muse, yeah.
Yeah, so Muse, it just happened to be kind of a coincidence for me listening to them. I was driving to my last final to school, and
so for context, really fast, Muse released a new single called Dig Down. And yeah, go back to that.
Yeah, so yeah, popped on the radio right then, and that was the first time it was played in the U.S. apparently, so kind of a chance sighting. So, and then they had a little interview afterwards citing the song and what they wanted to do with it. So the song is kind of, if you remember The Second Law, their album in 2012, very electronic-y, try to do a different sound, more bass heavy, I guess you could say. They went back to that sound more for this song.
Close to the edge, or with a gun to your head, you must find a way. When free.
It's the past album, Drones, 2015, I believe.
Yeah.
It was more of their normal rock stuff, but this song is going back to their, you know, Madness or Panic Station, whatever, from that album.
Yeah.
And it's a very good song, in my opinion. I like it. So they had the interview, a little, about 10, 15 minute thing on it. And they wanted to, inspiration for the world, because apparently they didn't think they were going to coming back with music this soon after their album. And
well, basically,
after they toured,
this was,
so.
Muse has always been a fairly political band. And
fairly,
like,
yeah.
And fairly. The last album is called Drones.
Yeah,
I mean,
no,
like, let's not kid ourselves. Muse has always been a very political band, highly political band, you might say. And of course, every musician ever since the election has always had their, like, Donald Trump, Brexit, like,
whatever
what
is
the,
it is.
What is the world going take yeah. on things? And so, of course, it's kind of, like, expected that Muse would come out with something. I think I'm reading a Rolling Stone article where it's specifically, like, a response to, like, Trump related things.
Yeah, and they wanted to and difference for them to compare to a lot of other things, they wanted to show optimism for this one, for the future. And that's what they stated on their show, that they heard the song, they wanted to say, you know what, everything's looking bleak, we want to make music that the show optimism for the future, you know, with people coming together or whatever they want. And I think that's a kind of a good different take, because everything else that I've heard music-wise or whatever the past year really has been really down on the future.
Definitely the lyric, face the firing squad, against all odds you'll find a way, sings that very much.
Exactly.
Like,
it's perfect.
So my relationship to Muse is very interesting. Muse used to be maybe my third favorite band behind Gorillaz and Radiohead, but I feel like kind of after the Resistance in 2012, they kind of lost a little bit of their way. 2009, I'm sorry. Yeah. They kind of lost a little bit of their way as far as what their sound wanted to be. Every band, if you're around for like more than
a decade,
you've got to keep what like makes your band unique, but also adjusting your sound, because you can't just
put out the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there's definitely certain artists that I like, but they blur the line between, oh, we have a distinct sound, and oh, we're basically releasing the same song,
just different choruses here or there, and that's. And again, going back to what we were saying earlier with how music went downhill, that's what I felt like kept happening with just numerous artists keep pumping out albums that almost blended together, where you could say one song would sound the same on the same album. On a different album. And that was a big problem. So that's why I like the second law for Muse, because they try to change their sound, do something different. And I understand why a lot of people didn't like it. I mean, granted, because half the album's good, half the album is odd.
I remember writing, notes about Dig Down and talking about it here when we first had Audio Face. We just have to scrounge back for that if you want to listen to that in May of 2017. So that's a long ass time ago now. But with that, I was like, interesting. Like, it's like Dig Down is cool, because when I listened to it like the first time again on MBE, I was like, whoa, I did not expect them to like go really heavy on electronics again. I was like, this is a really cool sound. Let's get into this record. And with Simulation Theory, I really enjoy this record a lot. To me, it's one of my favorite return to forms on Audio Face, because I had almost given up on Muse, and just when I heard that they were coming out with stuff, I kind of discarded it. And so I listened to Dig Down, but I'm like, okay, let me still get back to this record. And we listened to it here on there on the podcast. And then just throughout the past 4 years that it's been out, I've really gotten to enjoy this record. It's such a really cool blend of 80s synths and stuff that they had never really done before. Like, they hadn't experimented with that sound, and it's within the concept, they still kept true to themselves as artists and kept true to the way that they wanted to make it, and experimented with synths and electronic that they haven't had before. Example, like the opening track, Algorithm, total electronic track.
Yeah.
But they added a piano to it at a minute in, and I was like, oh, this is fucking great. And I loved it.
Yeah, this Simulation Theory was the first time that I was able to, like, you know, meaningfully get to song 7 in a Muse album in a decade. I was like, God, holy days, happy days are here again. Wow, this is amazing. I felt that, you know, Simulation Theory, you can kind of get the idea of this Muse record. It's sort of the virtualization of things. I even almost hate, like, you know the meme, the vaporwave meme from like 2017, 2018 that came out of this, and Muse just took that. It's like, once again, Muse being heavy-handed, of course, but like, damn it, they're back. I think that this Simulation Theory is like we've learned our lessons from the past decade and applied them, because I honestly feel like Propaganda has the DNA of Madness. It has the DNA of Undisclosed Desires. It has the DNA of a lot of... It has the DNA...
From the Second Law.
Yeah, Propaganda has the DNA of Psycho, even, honestly. Like, I hear aspects of that coming together, but Propaganda really kind of comes together in a song that I honestly didn't even like as versus I thought, but it's probably my favorite song on Simulation Theory. But yeah, like, I was thinking about this record, and I was going, oh, I actually do like Pressure, and I come back to that quite often. Oh, I really do love Thought Contagion, and I like coming back that often. I think it's one of the first times, again, where I'm happy to hear that like the Muse vocals work together in tandem in a really nice way when the like the Thought Contagious chorus kind of like hits. Yeah, it's Break It To Me. I also really like as a track. I didn't think I'd expect to either because it's like
cool.
They do this like weird, almost like Egyptian, like thing in the middle of it. But it's like a really unique take or spin on them doing almost like 2000s alternative rock again. But it's new, it's fresh, it's really good. It feels kind of like edgy. And I was impressed. Still not a perfect record. I'm not even going to touch the deluxe version stuff, although I did like some of the deluxe version remixes, including I love a good rendition of an alternative rock song with a marching band. My favorite version of 15 Step is the one they did with the marching band.
With the USC marching band, yeah. Pressure with the UCLA marching band is actually pretty cool.
Little rivalry there, I see.
Yeah, right? Deadass.
Yeah, Muse picks UCLA, Radiohead picks USC. Interesting. Gorillaz, go Bears. No. Just kidding. They'd probably pick like a random school in like Mexico or something. But and no offense, like don't take this in any pejorative way to any band members or players anywhere. But so don't get me wrong, this isn't a perfect album by any means. This isn't like 2000s, this is the great Muse kind of thing. But this was the first return to form to Muse I would have given since like the Resistance in some parts of the Second Law. It took them about 9 years to kind of come around and do it, but I'm in a much better place with Muse right now.
100%. Me too.
Too political or not political enough to answer that question? I think that, yeah, sometimes they are way too political and they get like over the head with it. Sometimes they aren't, but like overall, all these different themes they talk about of like being disaffected from your government or these ideas like black holes and revelations, escaping the planet to go to a different place and like settle new things there too. The parallels of that with like all the SpaceX and billionaire ventures, the new Blue Origin ventures that are going on right now. Resistance was just perfectly timed for political uprisings. Drones was kind of maybe not less perfectly timed, but also coming at a moment where reckoning with the depersonalization of war, simulation theory, when we're kind of looking at like alternate reality and virtual reality. I think simulation theory is a little bit ahead of its time and maybe could have been even more heavy-handed with some of its messaging, because I think as we enter into a lot of augmented reality, virtual reality things in this decade, we'll be looking at simulation theory by Muse and going, oh wow, they were once again the boys were right on some of these things. But I'm glad with this Muse can really go either way with their next record, Will of the People. We reviewed their record, Won't Stand Down, which is...
It's definitely more of like early Origin of the Symmetry style sound.
Yeah. It's very rock sounding. It has a weird sort of like do-do-do-do-do-do thing in the back. I forget like the like percussion noises, but it's very interesting. I don't know how this album is going to sound, but we will be reviewing it at the end of this month, and you'll be able to listen to our opinions of it and our thoughts of it along with the context of this thing. You can actually even go back and listen to our simulation theory review if you're a member, you can listen to the podcast thing to let us know exactly what we thought about there, so you can find out exactly what we thought about there. But I'm very excited with Muse. I'm honestly, you never know when their last album could be. This could be last album. And I liked doing this retrospective because getting to revisit, it's been a ride, and getting to revisit a band that you liked a lot as a kid, as an adult, it hits different. Like watching cartoons you liked as a kid, as an adult, you understand certain things you didn't understand, even though you think what's not to understand? The lyrics are so very obvious, but also you get a sense of appreciation for a lot of the music. And literally, I like the Second Law now better than I did even when we did the last bonus episode. I absolutely trashed it before. Now I'm like, I think there's merit to the second half. I think it's good. It's just to release that after the Resistance, like it felt like there was something lacking and something missing there. And it's not like Muse is not a band that's incapable of doing it, but it seemed like Muse was a band that was incapable of completing an album for a while, or like really executing on an album the way mm-hmm. they did with Resistance and Black Holes and Revelations. With Simulation Theory, that brought me back to the light. We'll see what happens with Will of the People. It can really go either way. But that's what makes this all fun.
Yeah, that was fun. Yes. I like doing these. We definitely need to do one on Arctic Monkeys when they come out with the album this year, hopefully.
Oh, we're doing one on... I think next one up on the docket is the 1975.
Oh, yeah, because they're releasing in October, so we definitely got to do that.
We have done bonus episodes of the 1975, but with the last bonus episode, we literally just replayed the original bonus episode and then spliced two reviews together. So I think at this point, we can just go ahead and...
We can just go full at. And yeah. It's fine, because with the story and history of it, and this is what we like to do. We like to do it with bands that we both like, artists that we both really enjoy and like, and has like a point of the podcast and our friendship in general too. And it really get this a sense of why we like doing this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Muse are one of those formative bands and formative projects for us, and there's a lot for people, especially fans of rock and alternative and even a little bit of electronic, to enjoy and embrace. Also, if you're just into heavy politics and music, you'll definitely get that there as well. So a little bit of punk inspirations there. But that has been Audio Face. If you like these bonus episodes, please help and support us by becoming a Syndicate 23 member. You can get these things early. They get bonus episodes for anyone else. You get the archive of episodes as well. These are some of our most popular episodes, and we really do and like enjoy doing them. So thank you very much for watching and participating. Usually we do our weekly reviews show, where we'll be reviewing Will of the People by Muse, along with a lot of other different records, because 2022 is a legendary year in music. We will remember it's a legendary year in music, and we'll cover that music every single week. You can follow Audio Face Pod on Twitter or Instagram. Please subscribe on YouTube if you're not already, because we're posting videos all the time throughout the week. Also, make sure you're commenting on those videos, because that's when we find out what music you want us to listen to that we will review. We literally, someone commented on a video and was like, hey, listen to this single. Why aren't you listening to this guy? And we're like, okay, cool. We'll listen to it. We'll do it. And we oftentimes like it. So check it out. Check out all those things. Most in the description. Sean is on Twitter and Instagram, SW Suarez, if he trusts you. I am on Twitter and Instagram, or Twitter and TikTok, whether I trust you or not. I twitch them. I am on Twitter and Twitch, whether I trust you or not, at Dan from the Web. And on Instagram and TikTok, whether I trust you or not, at Dan from the Internet. Thank you very much for listening. 3-hour podcast pain. Cheers.